Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. We're talking about a new book, The DNA Restart, Unlock Your Personal Genetic Code to Eat for Your Genes, Lose Weight, and Reverse Aging. The author is Dr. Sharon Moalem. He's an MD, PhD. He's an innovator, an inventor. He's developed a novel class of antibiotic compounds directed against superbugs like MRSA. And he is the developer of a variety of patents. He's associate editor for the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. He's a renaissance man in the field of medicine. And I notice, Dr. Moalem, that you also wrote a book called Survival of the Sickest. That's a book that came on my radar screen, a couple of years ago. Can you, before we get back to the DNA Restart, your latest book, what does that mean, Survival of the Sickest?
So that was my first book. I was addressing this idea of in evolution that many genetic mutations are complicated blessings. And an example actually that overlaps when we think about diet and nutrition is mutations in a gene called MTHFR, methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because that is a hot topic.
Yeah. And so we know now that people who have certain mutations in those genes can need an increased intake of folate, but not just any kind of folate, specific forms of folate. And so from a survival of the sickest perspective, you know, you'd ask, well, why would certain people have mutations that put them at risk for multiple miscarriages and other health issues? And in that specific example, it's thought that having a lower availability of folate within cells protected individuals when they were infected with malaria.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are kind of, you could think of them as complicated blessings that helped their ancestors survive. And yet today, in a very different world where you're not dealing with the challenges of malaria, having the mutations in those genes can be rather complicated.
You know, actually, this is the basis of slavery in the Americas, because originally they tried to colonize South America and the Caribbean islands with people from places like Scotland and England and Portugal, and they all died. They didn't have resistance to the disease, but what they found is that if they wanted people to work and harvest the sugar cane, that they needed to import Africans who had built-in resistance to malaria and some of these tropical diseases. And the current epidemic of sickle cell and things like Mediterranean anemia are actually protective against malaria. So they're, in a sense, that is survival of the sickest. In that book, do you address concerns that maybe we've put an end to selective pressure in evolution, and in effect, we've helped people to survive who are, you know, not the most robust genetic material? Maybe we're, it sounds a little like eugenics, but maybe we're diluting our gene pool by, you know, with modern medical advances that help people who'd otherwise have died young survive.
That may be the case, and as well as you know, the idea that evolution is still happening today. It's the direction we may be shaping and playing a big role in how that's happening. But I think that concept surprises a lot of people, because they think that evolution is only something that, you know, happened in the long kind of past. But definitely modern medicine is shaping the future genetics of humanity. Every time a family goes through genetic testing and decides what to do with those results, there's going to be an impact on a future generation, definitely.
Indeed. So, you know, you live in New York, or at least part of the time you spend in New York, because you seem to be quite a foodie. You go to restaurants and you talk a lot about your experiences in, you know, with some of the top chefs in the world. And in the book, you have some particular insights about flavor.
Right.
Talk about that, because in the DNA Restart, you talk about umami. What is that?
So what I had a big challenge with, and of course, I knew I wasn't the only one. The more people I spoke to, the more I heard about this issue. Is, of course, you could have a lot of starch-heavy foods, such as crackers and a lot of bread, and never seem to get satiated. You can get physically full, like, you know, your stomach can get full of food, but you always find yourself still hungry. And so to kind of get at the bottom of this, I relooked at all the human tastes. And the most recent one, which is the fifth taste, is called umami. And it's a Japanese word that means deliciousness. And what triggers it is specific amino acid, acids, or 5-ribonucleic acids, and that are present in our food. And many of these ingredients, I learned from some of the top chefs around the world, is their secret ingredients to get that delicious flavor. And if you think about a common soup stock, what makes a soup satiating, and this pertains to soups from cuisines all over the world, because really what you're consuming is water. And this was an invention that happened in many parts of the world where when you're trying to feed people with not a lot of food and try to make it go a bit further, you use a lot of water. So how do you get people feeling satiated? Essentially eating water. And so soup stock is also full of umami. And, and the minute that you start breaking down proteins through fire and fermentation, you're releasing more of that sensation. And so I started to work around this theory that by increasing the umami quotient in a meal, you can help trigger satiety and get people to feel full, or not just physically full, but satiated a lot earlier and faster with a lot less food. And a simple example is making sure to add Parmesan, which is one of the richest sources of glutamate, which triggers umami. To, you know, your pasta dish. And so many people are actually not thinking that, they're trying to reduce their intake of specific foods. So they would leave out sharp cheeses or, Parmesan, not realizing that that actually may be serving their purpose of getting satiated with a lot less food.
And of course the modern, interpretation of umami. In the past, the Japanese, used, bonito flakes or something like that, or fish sauce to flavor foods. And, you know, it's very common in Asian cooking. But then they, in an industrialized, iteration of that, they developed MSG, which is pure umami, right? And not so great for you because of its very, pure chemical nature.
Exactly. And I make that distinction, in the book because, many of the food additives, which, so, you know, I kind of distinct between artificial and natural umami. It's the same kind of concept that, many natural foods contain natural sugars, but adding extra sugar, artificial sugar to foods that, are low in nutrition, but maybe high in calories is a kind of processing trick that food producers use. And so adding MSG to food that might be of lower quality, might be getting you, from a flavor perspective, making food more passable. But the idea is to try to take advantage of umami in its natural state, and especially combining the two different types of umami. So one from an amino acid and one from a ribonucleic acid. And, you can do that by, using, say, tomatoes and dried shiitake mushrooms. The tomatoes are a rich source of glutamate, and the shiitake mushrooms would be providing guanylate. And this is called umami synergism, where you get an even stronger umami flavor. And many vegetarian and vegan cuisines around the world are great at using mushrooms and, say, miso and all these fermented foods because they were trying to increase the amount of umami present because of the lack of or the inability to use animal-derived foods.
And that may be why you the foreword to your book is written by Chef Nobu Matsuhisa. So does that mean that you're able to get a table at Nobu at you know, any night you want?
I should hope so. He was a great influence, and it was a wonderful experience meeting him because, you know, learning firsthand from a chef how they think about umami, because they're not always approaching food from a nutrition or a health perspective, but that's actually something that's really important to Chef Nobu that we both are sharing and trying to help get the word out, is that Delicious food doesn't mean that the food needs to be unhealthy. In fact, it could be exactly the opposite. The most delicious, umami-rich food could actually be exactly what your genes need.
Interesting. And, you know, for those of you who are not, New York foodies, getting a table at Nobu, you know, sometimes you have to offer your firstborn in order to get a reservation next month. It's hard to get in. Popular place. Okay. So you actually describe in the book, your own experience, with cholesterol. You were told that you had a high cholesterol. You went to the doctor, and to your surprise, you're an inveterate athlete, and you're slim and trim, and you thought you were in great shape. You were told you had a high cholesterol. And then you did a little dietary experiment on yourself. What happened?
Yeah, so, you know, this actually happened in my teens. And at the time, the dietary recommendation was that I got from my physician was to cut out as much cholesterol as possible. And so I went on a very low cholesterol, very low fat diet. And to my surprise, and especially my physician's, who was sure that I must have been sneaking a lot of cholesterol-rich foods, was when I came back a few months later, my cholesterol actually increased. And from a genetics perspective, this shouldn't be a surprise, because it's very likely that the genes I inherited make sure that I can make enough cholesterol. And by restricting my intake, what I actually was telling my body was that I'm in an environment that is cholesterol poor. Hmm. And so my endogenous, or my own body's ability to produce, got kicked into overdrive.
Interesting. So that's an interesting interpretation of why sometimes diet doesn't matter. It's almost like you have a set point for cholesterol. By the way, and you were told you had not such a good HDL, or your HDL was okay?
My HDL actually was low as well. And this dietary change, I ended up with an even higher LDL and a lower HDL.
Right.
And so it was really when, you know, I went back and increased my cholesterol intake, that my cholesterol ended up going back down. So it can be counterintuitive, but again, we've all inherited different genes that work in different environments, and finding out the right combination of nutrition for our genes is key.
You're a big fan of oolong tea. In fact, you devote a whole section to oolong tea. What are some of the benefits of that particular beverage?
Well, first off, I've always been a tea drinker, especially green tea. And unfortunately, though, I fall into that 20% of the population that drinking green tea daily end up with mild gastritis, or a mild irritation of the stomach. And so I always was looking for an alternative, you know, some kind of calorie-free, polyphenol-rich beverage I could drink. And so happened upon oolong tea, and traveled to Asia, to China and Taiwan to learn more about it. And I was really surprised to find out that actually millions of people drink oolong daily and don't have any type of digestive issue. And this was actually discovered more than 2,000 years ago, where Chinese physicians are practicing traditional Chinese medicine, noted that if you process green tea and let it oxidize a little bit, it's the same process of watching a banana peel go from green to yellow to black. So if you let it go from, say, that green, as in green tea, to a more yellow color, which is like an oolong, that the irritating compounds will dissipate. And of course, they didn't know what the exact compounds were, but they came up with a processing mechanism to get oolong a little bit more oxidized. And so what does that do for us besides gastritis? It actually cranks up the amount of polyphenols, that are produced, because there's enzymes in the leaf. And as that leaf withers and oxidizes, it converts some of those compounds to chemicals such as thiocyanins. And many of these chemicals have the ability to bind our dietary fat and prevent their absorption, which is a great way, of course, to help us lose weight. And in some animal studies, it's been shown to increase, to decrease specifically visceral or, you know, the dreaded belly fat. And, what we're discovering as well, as if you are drinking that tea with your your meal that has the most fat in it, then that'll have the greatest effect, because while you're eating, that the oolong tea will go and absorb that dietary fat and prevent you from absorbing it.
Hmm. It's interesting. You share your preference for oolong tea with a recent guest who's written a book about allergy, Dr. Leo Galland, and his belief is that oolong tea is an allergy solution because it helps the body more rapidly detox foreign materials and process them more readily. Yeah.
Interesting.
You also, you have a lot of culinary tips in the book, and this is something that I didn't know. I'm an impatient cook, so when I chop my garlic, I just chop it up and then I throw it into whatever I'm making. But you have some insights into how to make your garlic more nutritionally potent.
Yes, and to be honest, I was fascinated with this as well and followed, you know, your idea of trying to get the garlic in as fast as possible. But there's an enzyme called alanase that's found naturally in garlic. And when garlic is chopped or bruised in any way or crushed, this activates the enzyme and it converts alanin to allicin, which is a much more potent phytonutrient. But you have to wait for that action to happen. And this enzyme is actually very heat sensitive. So if you're throwing in that garlic right away, as you described, you're not allowing that enzyme to work. And so many of the culinary tips I go over in the book have you actually prepare foods in a specific order. So the first thing that I recommend and I'm a proponent of is if you're going to use garlic before you do anything in the kitchen for food preparation, get your garlic, chop it, bruise it, and set it aside for at least 5 minutes. And that way you'll be maximizing the phytonutrients that you'll be getting as you cook and then eat your food.
Interesting tip. I'll be doing that from here on in. You have in your book something called the emulsifier busting list. And, yes, you know, this is based on some recent research that highlights the downsides of some of these chemicals. Tell us about that.
Sure. What I did was in work and research trying to understand you know, why are we seeing so many more food intolerances, especially as it pertained to gluten? And the one addition to our processed foods, and especially to baked goods, is the addition of emulsifiers. And these are chemicals that have sometimes detergent or soap-like properties and are used either to keep ingredients together and so are actually found many different forms of emulsifiers are found in gluten-free foods to keep everything bound together, but they're also found in traditionally baked artisanal bread, and they use them as dough conditioners to speed up the baking process. And unfortunately, for labeling laws, many of these emulsifiers don't even have to be listed because they were thought to be benign. And an interesting research study that was published recently showed that even giving animals at a very low dose of emulsifiers, much lower than what an average person might be exposed to, it could trigger a low-grade inflammation within the intestines, and then many of the animals overate as a result as well and gained weight. And the thinking is, and in the study this came up, was that the emulsifiers are their detergent properties are dissolving or removing the mucus layer in the gut. And then the microbiota that are there naturally but are usually separated from the surface of the gut are then brought very close to the gut, to the surface of the gut cells, the enterocytes that are lining the gut. And that's the trigger for inflammation. And what they found was that you need to remove emulsifiers for at least 4 to 8 weeks before you have any resolution of that inflammation, but having that low-grade inflammation then creates all kinds of food intolerances, you know, including a lactose intolerance, because many of those enterocytes are producing enzymes that then they release to help you absorb and metabolize your food. So I came up with a list that people can start using to remove emulsifiers from their diet, and emulsifiers are actually even found, are common and found in toothpaste. So there's a small percentage of the population that, that are sensitive to sodium lauryl sulfate, which is an emulsifier, a common emulsifier found in toothpaste. And by removing that, many of them have resolution of mouth sores or aphthous ulcers that, again, is thought to be caused by the same kind of mechanism. The sodium lauryl sulfate is, has a detergent or soap-like property. It's removing the mucus layer of the gums of your mouth and then prompting an immune response and the sores forming.
Good stuff. Well, the complete list is to be found in the book, The DNA Restart. You talk about the importance of exercise. You talk about the importance of sleep in the book. Can you touch upon those briefly?
Definitely. So when it comes to exercise, we're understanding, or you know, it's been known that, you know, there's many benefits physiologically. We often don't think about what exercising can do for our genes from a longevity perspective. And interestingly enough, we now know that exercise can trigger, especially high intensity exercise, can trigger muscle cells to release interleukin-15. And what that does is triggers our mitochondria that aren't working really well or aren't working optimally to be replaced. And so this, doing this type of exercise then, you know, gives you almost like a mitochondrial upgrade, if you think about it, perfecting, the body's ability to produce energy. But you need to be exercising to get that, that upgrade. And so we have a lot more genetic, resolve. It's just, we have to kind of exercise and force our body to bring that online. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to sleep, we now know that the quality of our chromosomes and the genetic material is affected by having a lack of sleep, and so not sleeping long enough is one way to erode our genetic material. So just another reason to make sure that we get enough sleep and rest and to maintain our genetic health over time.
Great stuff. All, you know, all that and more in the DNA Restart. So what's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action, Dr. Moylan? Do you have a website? Can people learn more about the book?
Yeah, it's actually DNArestartthebook.com, which links out to many articles and some genetic self-tests that people can start doing at home.
Yeah, well, congratulations. I think the book is embedded with lots of nuggets of information that, that can make people maximize their genetic potential. That's really what it's all about. We're dealt a set of cards, but it's not our fate necessarily to be hamstrung by our liabilities. We can overcome them. We can also accentuate our positive traits by harnessing positive lifestyle measures. And you talk about those in the book. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Hoffman.
My pleasure.